Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. I can only see myself, so I can tell you I have four little kids between the ages of 1.5 and 10, and they're all outside the door in all the rest of the house. So I'm in our bomb shelter. Every Israeli home, as most of you I'm sure know, has a bomb shelter, and this is my guest room slash bomb shelter. And I sometimes have to take calls here, and my kids have graciously put stickers on the wall behind me to try and color up the place. So you're welcome. So that's by way of introduction about my background. I want to tackle this question. We have very little time, and I want to present something that I hope will be actually very, very useful about something very, very momentary. You know, this particular election cycle, Israeli election cycles are 90 days. I think we're now 36 days out, or maybe we're already 35 days out to election day on March 23rd. And so it's a very momentary thing, you know, the state of play and where the parties are. So I want to try and lay out something that is about the state of play. It is about where things are at this moment, the strategies of the different campaigns, but that when you take it in as a whole, really tells you something profound and important about how Israeli politics work. Because they work very differently, obviously, from the United States, and even from systems that are similar to Israel in structure. The national party list system, it's a little bit like what Italy has, but it functions very differently here for reasons that have to do with the way Israeli society is structured bottom up, and how Israelis think about their identity and their political affiliation. So I'm going to try and talk about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's campaign, some of his thinking, some of the most controversial things that have happened so far in the campaign, namely his concerted, open, public, admitted effort to try and get Kahanists and outright racists into the Knesset, why that is, you know, beyond the moral question, and he's been asked about it, and he's had to answer about it, and he's been embarrassed by it, and he's tried to explain it in various ways. There's a very important tactical question that he is trying to grapple with, that I think when you grasp his concern, really opens up a lot of understanding about how Israeli politics work, how the left works, how the right works, and exactly how much we're deadlocked and have been deadlocked for more than 2 years, when neither side has really been able to win, even though neither side is also outright lost. So we are now, as I said, 36 days to the election. This is our fourth election in 2 years, obviously. April 2019, we had an election that we thought was a normal election. The roughly 49 days of negotiating, of coalition negotiations after election day that are given to party leaders by law after each election, came to an end on May 30. And hours before the deadline for forming a government, or the Knesset is dissolved automatically and we go to another election, hours before the deadline, it turned out Netanyahu could not negotiate a coalition with Avigdor Lieberman's Israel Beitenu party and the ultra-Orthodox parties in the same government. And on May 30, 2019, for the first time in the history of Israel, an election failed to produce a government. The Knesset, Netanyahu teamed up with, you might not be aware of this, the Arab parties, which did very poorly in April 2019 and wanted a new go-round. Netanyahu didn't want to give the chance to Gantz on May 30, 2019 to form a coalition. So they both teamed up and they voted the dissolution of the 21st Knesset. The 21st Knesset lasted roughly 6 weeks. It survived a little bit longer because then there was a 90-day election period that was called, but that was it for the 21st Knesset. And we went to, again, unprecedented, a new election in September. That election was just as deadlocked, although the Arab parties did much better, so they were very happy. They were completely uninterested in going to get another election in March, but Likud came in very small. Netanyahu saw that he could call elections, and so he did. And so we went to an election in March 2020. And by March 2020, everything had changed. Everything had changed because, of course, the pandemic had reached Israel. And we weren't quite sure what it meant, but by after Election Day, by the end of March, it was already very clear that this was going to be something very big, very serious, that would have tremendous economic consequences. We were already seeing terrifying numbers, not only coming out of the East, out of China, But we were seeing the beginning of spread in Europe that was being handled very poorly by the European countries, and some of the consequences were becoming clear. Israel began to go into one of its first rounds of restrictions or lockdowns. We haven't had very strict lockdowns exactly. We've had sort of an oscillating constant lockdown that has come in waves of new restrictions that are then lifted. So Israel is going into one of those tightenings of the lockdown. And Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu feared, both of them, another election. Netanyahu, because an election during the pandemic would be a roll of the dice. The usual political rules might not apply. And Benny Gantz, because the polls were showing people very, very exhausted by the repeated elections, especially as the coronavirus was really starting to spread. And there were centrists who were willing to just let Netanyahu have it already, just to be done with the elections themselves. And so he was worried about the polls. He was also genuinely, I think, worried about the country, and it needed a unity government. And so Beto established a unity government, shattering the center-left camp that had united behind Gantz across those three elections, and formed this unity government that has served us very poorly for the last year. I mean, catastrophically poorly. I mean, incredibly poorly. There were some things that this country did very well during this period, I think, on issues of foreign policy, certainly with the Abraham Accords. I think on the vaccination drive, Netanyahu deserves tremendous amount of credit for that. Not sole credit. He's turned it into the centerpiece of his campaign, so it's hard to remember that, in fact, there were capabilities that Israel could offer to drug companies, to the vaccine companies, the information that it could offer. Israel is also, Israel is essentially the best test case country that the vaccine companies had access to, because it's essentially an island. It has very few land borders that can be readily crossed. And so they could, unlike European countries, which can produce good data, but can't close borders. Israel has all these different factors that made Pfizer and Moderna and others really want Israel to be their first test case, so they could find out about allergies and different age groups and all the different things that ordinary test trials don't give you, but massive populations do give you. And Netanyahu used that fact to bring the vaccines here and try and get us out of the pandemic earlier. So that was a success. But so many other things were not a success. We haven't passed a state budget voted on by the Knesset since March of 2018. That means that there are just thousands of reforms that are stuck. That means that when the school year came back briefly for about 3 weeks in September, the first week of the school year, there wasn't a budget for youth at risk programs and tutoring programs for disadvantaged kids in disadvantaged areas. And just a third of the school wasn't paid for because there was no state budget and everything is running on these stopgap spending bills. The country has been run in total chaos, where the politics of Netanyahu and the politics of Gantz have dominated all decision-making, including decision-making about the pandemic. Decisions were made to open, decisions were made to close, enforcement gaps tracked exactly with the political needs of the leadership. Netanyahu didn't want to upset his Haredi coalition partners, therefore there was less enforcement in Haredi areas, one-to-one and always timed exactly to their political needs. Israelis are very disappointed with their political leadership. And I say all of that as the beginning, as sort of the background, the bedrock of the question, so what's happening now in the fourth election? And what we're seeing in the fourth election is, I think, two things. One, surprising stability in the camps. In other words, blue and white used to be this enormous coalition that brought together the secularists of Yesh Atid, the sort of center-left, hawkish, security-minded, Ashkenazi kind of elite that used to be represented in the Labour Party, is no longer represented in the Labour Party, and really found a home under Benny Gantz, who is a symbol of that part of Israeli society. It used to be all of these different groups, and the Israeli left, and in many ways the Arabs, although the relationship there was always tense. It used to be the symbol of this coalition of Israeli groups. And then there was the right, and the right itself was a very complex place. A lot of the right didn't like Netanyahu. Avigdor Lieberman, after May 30, 2019, when he pulled out of the coalition talks with Netanyahu and essentially forced the first failed election in Israel's history, if you could call it that. When Avigdor Lieberman did that, he almost doubled his size of his party. In other words, his voters rewarded him for refusing to join a coalition with Netanyahu, which guaranteed that he wouldn't do it in the future, right? So he has stuck to the secularist center-left, even though on many, many issues he's very right-wing, but on social issues and secularism and the religion and state questions, he is more with the left. So everything kind of got jumbled up. And, you know, there's never been in Israel a single-party government, right? Not even in the days of David Ben-Gurion could one party win an election in the sense that it literally had 61 seats out of 120. There's always been coalitions. You've always had to piece together coalitions, even in the most fantastical, imagined, you know, successful elections of Mapai under David Ben-Gurion. And that suggests that if all of the chaos that I've just described, and I don't expect you to remember the details, but the music, you know, Israelis have experienced this unbelievable turmoil, unbelievable turnover, parties shifting sides and loyalties, and the right winger who's with the left and the left winger who's with the right and the different groups that are all, what does any of it mean? Throughout the chaos, what we're discovering, among other things, we're discovering that even though the parties shift like shadows, you know, dancing in the sunlight under swaying trees, this is turning into a haiku, the fundamental votes are not changing. Voters are moving around the won't sit with Netanyahu block, some of who these voters are right-leaning, some of them are left-leaning. Voters are moving around the will sit with Netanyahu block. Some are ultra-Orthodox, some, you know, voting for what is now Religious Zionism's new party that's built on the old, you know, Mafdal, the old National Religious Party, or actually the old National Union Party. It doesn't matter the details, but voters are moving around. We're seeing hundreds of thousands of voters moving, shifting between parties. But on the basic question of who's going to win the election, Netanyahu is still polling at 58 seats, just like he polled in April 2019, and in September, and in March, and we're now 2 years later. And the fundamental question of how you build that coalition that delivers victory for Netanyahu or denies Netanyahu victory and delivers it to someone else, that basic layout remains. And so there's a fundamental political reality that is bottom up among voters that is not reflected in the political system itself through the parties themselves. That's big, that's complicated, that's interesting. There's a detachment between loyalty to party and loyalty to cause. Parties are struggling to align themselves to where the people are. The people are no longer loyal to parties outside of really Likud and the ultra-Orthodox parties are no longer loyal. And even they're not all of them, and not even, I would say maybe a third of Likud is disconnected from Netanyahu into other right-wing parties. Parties have become disconnected and are now trying to align now with where voters want them to be. So the whole system is in flux, the whole system is in chaos, but that's the party system. The social reality, the social fabric itself is roughly the same. There are two camps, they have two senses of where the country should be going, they profoundly disagree, and they are in a kind of deadlock that is real and deep. It's wrong, I think, to blame Netanyahu for the deadlock. And it's wrong to blame, you know, Gantz for failing to win. And it's wrong. There's a real deadlock. It's profound. It's deep. It's about fundamental social and cultural questions. And I think we're discovering that now that the party system has radically reorganized itself and changed absolutely nothing in the final coalition calculations. That's one point. And my second point, and I'll do this one very quickly so that in 2 minutes we can open up to questions. And then you'll guide the conversation. My second point is about Netanyahu's tactics. Netanyahu has done something that has brought a lot of criticism, including from yours truly, but from also much, much more important people than yours truly. He worked very hard, and not for the first time, to get a group of extremists, racists, and I mean really, actually, I try very hard to make sure that nothing I ever say can reveal who I vote for. I also have to tell you, I personally am capable, knowing the people, knowing the parties, knowing what they represent, knowing their arguments, of voting for a very broad cross-section of Israeli politics. I don't believe in party loyalty. And I think we have quite a good political class, with all of the problems that I spend all day criticizing them, that my profession is to criticize them. And yet I think they're actually a fairly good political class. But Otzma Yehudi, the party led by Itamar Ben-Gvir, who Netanyahu promised political positions to the National Union Party to ensure that it unites with Otzma Yehudi so that it makes it past the 3.25% threshold to get into the Knesset, the party that Netanyahu has guaranteed and engineered their entry into the Knesset, including handing religious Zionism, the Religious Zionism Party, a Knesset seat on Likud's Knesset slate, including guaranteeing them two cabinet ministries, including intervening in a primary race in a separate party to try and convince them to join the double party Religious Zionism list to bolster it even more. Netanyahu has spent hours on the phone working to get the most extreme element in Israeli politics that isn't actually illegal into the Knesset. Actual racist. Itamar Ben-Gvir has a photograph, has a poster of Baruch Goldstein hanging in his living room to this day. And he's proud of that poster. Baruch Goldstein is the man who in 1994 walked in to the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron and murdered 29 Muslim worshippers at prayer and wounded another 130 roughly. He is one of the most villainous and heinous and horrifying terrorists in the history of Israel. He is a Jew. He is an embarrassment. And he is hanging on the wall in Itamar Ben-Gvir's living room. And Itamar Ben-Gvir is the man that Benjamin Netanyahu is making sure gets into the Knesset. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu was asked about that constantly, a dozen times in the last 2 weeks. But yesterday on Channel 12, on their nightly news broadcast, the most watched news broadcast in Israel, he was asked by the anchor, Yonit Levy, you know, are you going to make him a minister? How could you get him into the government? What about the fact that he's got these views about Arabs? And Netanyahu gave an explanation that I think was fascinating. And I wanted to say it here and really 1 minute, because I think it reveals a lot about how Netanyahu does politics, but it also, I think, which is very important because he's, of course, prime minister, and I don't know if he'll win in 36 days or in the negotiations that follow, but I know that he's slightly better placed to win than any of the people trying to beat him. So it's quite likely we'll have a fifth election too, if the current polls bear out. But it's very important to understand how he does politics. But more than that, it's important to understand that Israeli politics is this chaos math of 11, 12, sometimes 14 different parties all angling around each other. And without grasping that chaos, which is absolutely mind-bending, none of it makes sense. In other words, it's always going to be confusing until you understand that it is confusing, that it is inherent to itself. Its best practitioners are constantly confused. Netanyahu explained that Itamar Ben-Gvir is not the first time that the Kahanists have come into the Knesset. Of course, Meir Kahana himself was in the Knesset, but Michael Ben-Ari was the former head of the Otzma Yehudit party, and he was in the Knesset, got into the Knesset in 2009 as part of another coalition of right-wing parties, and he sat in the coalition even though he wasn't in the government, he wasn't the cabinet minister. Now, that's what he said on national television. That's not true. Michael Ben-Ari was not in the coalition. National Union was actually left out of the coalition in 2009 in Netanyahu's second government from 2009 to 2013. But the reason that the four-seat National Union Party with Michael Ben-Ari was left out of the coalition in 2009 was that Netanyahu went to Ehud Barak after that election, the head of the Labor Party, and Netanyahu said to him in 2009, my friend Ehud, right? Who defeated Netanyahu in 1999 to become prime minister and was then prime minister until 2001. Netanyahu says to Ehud Barak, I have something with National Union, a very narrow government. And what that means is, I think it was a 62-seat majority out of 120. And what that means is that whatever the crazy right-wing fascists say, I'm dependent on them. I can't do anything. I can't pass a budget without them. Do you want Israel to be led now, Netanyahu tells Barak, by a government dependent on these extremists? Or are you going to do the responsible thing and join my government as defense minister, as, you know, right-hand man, as the, you know, alternate prime minister when I'm overseas or whatever, as the second in the government? Will you join my government, give me an enormous majority of 74, I think it was in the end, or some very large majority, and we can leave the extremists out of the government? And the government won't be a government dependent on them, which is the situation today. Because Labor at the time had 13 seats or something significant. I think you had a coalition over 70. And Barak agreed. And when Barak went to the Labor Party Central Committee, which has to approve his joining the coalition, he said to them, guys, if I don't go into this coalition, and we'll have the defense ministry, and we'll prevent, you know, Netanyahu from doing anything crazy right-wing like annexation or, you know, the way the Labor Party talks, Barak went to the Labor Party Central Committee, and he says, vote to approve this, because otherwise Mikhail Ben-Ali is going to hold the government hostage on every bill they try to advance, and it'll essentially be a far-right government that we don't want, that would be a monstrous thing, right? Netanyahu has now ensured, all but ensured, according to polls, and again, 36 days is a long time in Israeli politics, 36 days ago, by the way, about half of the Knesset was radically different than it is now in the polls. So that could happen again. If the current polls bear out, Netanyahu has ensured that Itamar Ben-Gvir is in the government. Netanyahu is also polling in his best polls, in his most optimistic polls, with his right-wing coalition of parties that have said they will support him, and with Ben-Gvir making it in at 62 seats, which is to say he will be dependent on Ben-Gvir. The problem with Itamar Ben-Gvir is that he's not reliable. Netanyahu can't trust him to support him loyally in exchange for handing him certain policy areas, you know, that'll be just his. That's the relationship between Netanyahu and the ultra-Orthodox parties. They handle their policy areas, and they let Netanyahu run the country. He can't have that agreement with Ben-Gvir. Ben-Gvir will have opinions on everything, from the American president to what to do with the Houthis in Yemen, to, you know, to questions of religion and state, to just any topic that he feels like. And he's not at all loyal to Netanyahu. And the more noise and the more trouble he causes, the higher he goes in the polls as the right wing, right pressure on Netanyahu. So Netanyahu wants Ben-Gvir neutralized. He doesn't want to be dependent on Ben-Gvir. And yet he has worked to push Ben-Gvir into the Knesset with him. And I have suggested, we'll know in 36 days or 45 days or whatever, whether I'm being silly, that Ben-Gvir is pulling a Ben-Ari. That Netanyahu, I'm sorry, is pulling the same trick from 2009 today. Netanyahu has a problem that half the Knesset, we've just seen across three election cycles, refuses to sit with him. And he has just badly mistreated Benny Gantz. He promised him a rotation agreement and then refused to pass a state budget just to prevent that rotation agreement over a year with a pandemic and economic crisis. Nobody trusts Netanyahu any farther than they can throw him. People have already said, Bennett has said openly, if I have a rotation agreement with Netanyahu because I turn out to be the second largest party and he needs me for the coalition, and I'm going to demand to have a rotation as prime minister, I'm going to go first. Why am I going to go first? Because I just can't trust the man. I just literally can't, and nobody can. And nobody even asked him how he could say such a thing, but nobody could trust Netanyahu to fulfill any commitment. You can't work with Netanyahu on credit. You have to work with Netanyahu in cash, is a very commonly heard phrase in the Knesset nowadays. And so I'm finishing last sentence. I'm sorry, I've gone too long. But just the last sentence, Netanyahu needs, I believe he's building not a right-wing coalition of 62 that will finally win. You know, he's been so close to 61-seat majority for 2 years, four elections. He's finally going to have 62, and that'll be him home free. At 62, he's dependent on literally two NKs to survive every no-confidence vote. He had a 61-seat coalition about 6 years ago, or I think 5 years ago, before Lieberman came into the government. I have to look up the exact date. But he had a 61-seat coalition, and a single NK could force policy changes on fundamental policy. That's how a major law restricting advertising of tobacco products was passed, because a member of Knesset named Glick, Yehuda Glick, That was his obsession, and he was willing to commit political suicide on it. And he told Netanyahu, "I'm not voting for you for your budget, for the state budget, unless you give me my tobacco, you know, saving our kids from tobacco bill." And Israeli law on advertising tobacco products changed because it was a 61C coalition. No other reason. I happen to think it's a great law. It's just you can't run a government with a 61C coalition. What Netanyahu was hoping for is that he will be able to come to the left or to the center or to the Yesh Atid crowd or to somebody and say to them, even if it's 3 MKs, 6 MKs, he'll be able to say to them, "Hey, you really want the government? You guys don't have a government. We're all going to a fifth election, or Ben-Gvir gets to decide everything. Come save the country from Ben-Gvir by joining my coalition." I'm done. Netanyahu has done it before. That's what Israeli coalition strategy looks like. That's how it works. It's very Talmudic, and it's incredibly complex. And interpreting Israeli coalitions and elections, that's how hard it can be. And now I'm stopping, and we'll open it up. I throw the baton back to you, Asaf.
Great. Well, thank you for that enlightening and unpacking the chaos, which is, of course, the miracle of Israel's existence is how Israeli politics actually works. And probably the miracle of Zionism is how, you know, they run a country. So that's always fascinating altogether. There's a lot to talk about. We have a lot of questions. But let me give the first question to Alex to start us off, and then we will open up the floor to as many questions. As I said before, I saw people already typing in their questions on the chat. If you have other questions, you could always raise as well. But Alex, why don't you start us off?
Okay, sure. Again, let me offer my thanks as well. Really a fantastic presentation about an utterly chaotic and confusing situation, at least from the perspective of outsiders, even you know, concerned outsiders such as ourselves. Let me get right to my question. Two related sectors or issues that you didn't really touch upon, the status of the Israeli left and the status of the Arab list. I looked it up. I think Meretz, Labor, and Gesher have 3 seats in between them. Is that about right? Can you comment about where these sectors are at and how they figure in to this year's electoral calculus?
Sure. Very briefly, the Labour Party was dead. It was polling under the threshold. The Labour Party that founded the country, the Labour Party that built many, many of the institutions of the country, from the army, whose essential infrastructure in the first few years was simply built upon the Haganah, and to the health funds, to the labor unions. It produced many of the problems Israel had to overcome over its history, and it also produced many of its strengths. That Labour Party, that storied institution, was dead. It was literally polling very, very low, and it was gone, and it was not going to come back. And then someone won a primary race in the party named Nerav Mikhaeli. Nerav Mikhaeli is interesting, because Labour had just 3 MKs in the last election. And those MKs were caucusing with Benny Gantz. And then when Benny Gantz took half of his blue and white coalition into the unity government with Netanyahu and half stayed out with Yesh Atid, the 3-seat Labour Party went with Gantz, except only 2 of those seats went with Gantz, because Mirav Mikhaeli, the 3rd MK, after Amir Peretz and Itzik Shmuli, said, "I just can't. I just cannot sit in a Netanyahu coalition." I'll say more than that. Labour has collapsed. It began a profound collapse in the 90s with all the large parties shrinking, a little bit because of direct election prime minister, but it really collapsed after the second intifada when many, many Israelis, including mainly on the left, concluded that the Oslo process had not delivered what it had promised. But it absolutely collapsed to the catastrophic point where it's basically going and it's gone. That collapse came about when Ehud Barak began in 2009 sitting under Netanyahu instead of being outside, being the opposition, being, in other words, Ehud Barak heard Netanyahu beg him to join him and prevent Michael Ben-Ali from controlling the country, and didn't grasp that having a Netanyahu who must rule the country with this extremist nobody wants as the guy calling the shots was a very good thing for the rehabilitation of the Israeli left after the Second Intifada, but instead went crawling to the Netanyahu government. That's been Mirab Michaeli's argument. The left brought upon itself its collapse by being constantly at the beck and call of the leader of the right over the last 12, 13 years. And she won the primary. And so she actually wouldn't caucus with the government, even though she was a party that had voted to go into that government. And she won the primary. She ordered Amir Peretz and Itzik Shmuli out of the government to resign immediately, at which point Amir Peretz and Itzik Shmuli announced that they resigned from the Labour Party. So they are now non-party cabinet ministers in the Israeli cabinet, and she immediately tripled and quadrupled Labour's poll showing. Immediately, Labour recovered to 5 seats in the pessimistic polls and 7 seats in the optimistic ones, at the expense of Ron Khulta'i's new party, at the expense of Ofer Shelach's new party. There were a few left-wing upstarts that evaporated. And Labour is now back as a small party, but as a resilient small party, and is not disappearing. I say that whole history because I want to say that, just like with the question of how the parties have all rejiggered themselves, but Netanyahu's coalition hasn't grown in the polls, that's what we're seeing on the Israeli left. The Israeli left doesn't trust left-wing parties, but doesn't work with Netanyahu, but doesn't want Netanyahu to win. In other words, there is still an Israeli left, and it is large and it is significant, and it doesn't trust the political leadership of the Israeli left. So, and we saw that in Labour disappearing, the Labour rebel winning the primary for party leader, and suddenly Labour exists again and is stable across polls for the last 3 weeks. I think there is an Israeli left. I think it's significant. I think many people don't call themselves left-wing, but agree with it and vote for it. And I think it has a credibility gap. And I share some of Mirav Michaeli's criticism of Ehud Barak. Part of the credibility gap is that it hasn't acted like an opposition. Even in periods when Netanyahu was in real crisis, it was generally there to rescue him in exchange for a few ministries, instead of really building a credible opposition. Yesh Atid is very liberal, but is not left-wing on national security issues and on the Palestinians. It's the very center of the road in Israeli political terms. That's the old Labour Party. So there is an Israeli left, and there isn't a political vehicle able to capture it and able to represent it. Mirav Michaeli thinks she can build it because her campaign, literally her campaign slogan, there's truth in politics. You can be honest in it. Politicians choose not to, but it is possible to be honest in politics. We're going to be honest in politics. That's our thing. That's all we're selling. If you like that, vote for us. It's worth 7 seats right now. The Arab List. On Thursday, I spoke with Amenad Yusuf Maklada. He's the most important pollster of the Arab community in Israel. The Arab community is very hard to poll. Large parts of the Arab community is very, very diverse culturally. Large parts of it are online and on, you know, Instagram and smartphones, and they're, you know, doctors and lawyers and whatnot. That's about 2/3 of the community are middle class. Christian Arabs have higher educational achievement rates than Jews in Israel. That's one sort of section of the Arab community. And then there are the Bedouin. And among the Bedouin, you have people without phones, you have people without ground lines, never mind cell phones or smartphones or, you know, internet apps that you can send questions to. And so polling Arabs is always very, very difficult in Israel. There's a party called Ra'am, whose base, a conservative Muslim party, whose base is among the Bedouin, who regularly in polls by Jewish pollsters get 1 seat, 2 seats, and then actually at the ballot box gets 5 seats. And it's because they literally don't know how to reach a lot of these Bedouin who vote for them. So the Arab parties, I called him because he has this tendency of getting it right with Arab voters, with predicting Arab voter behavior. And he says they're definitely going to shrink from the 15 and 13 that they got in the last two elections. He doesn't know if they're going to shrink down to 6 because Ra'am will get kicked out of the Knesset. It'll be under the threshold, and the other three parties will together get as low as 6. That's his most pessimistic projection. His most optimistic projection is that they'll shrink about 3 seats put together, but Ram does get in. The Arab community, that's the most optimistic. The Arab community turned out in record numbers in September 2019 and March 2020 and delivered enormous numbers to the Arab parties, the 4 Arab parties that were united into a joint slate, and feel like they haven't gotten anything for it. They haven't seen budgets moving. They haven't seen their needs taken care of by their parliamentarians. They've seen a lot of political jostling, ideological, you know, posturing. And there's a lot of anger there at their own parties. And we're now seeing a fascinating fallout from what is apparently going to be, again, 36 days is a long time, but it was apparently going to be a collapse of the Arab parties, which is that the Jewish majority parties, the Zionist parties, including Likud, have created unprecedented campaigns for the Arab community. Likud put out last week its very first Arabic language campaign video. Netanyahu has visited the Bedouin in the south and vaccination centers in Arab towns in the north. Some of those towns, it was the very first time he'd ever stepped foot in those towns, entire cities in Israel. And there is a very significant campaign for the Arab vote in Labor, in Meretz, where they're hovering around the threshold, and I hope the Arabs can save them and put them over the threshold. Yesh Atid yesterday, this morning, went to an Arab, I think, Arab community, which is the number one issue that Arab voters want addressed. So there's a, that's brand new. Everything I just said is brand new. And I think it's very positive, in fact.
Great, thank you for that. You froze for a little bit there, but let me, Alex, if you're okay, I'm gonna move on to some of the questions we have in the audience. Okay, so let me try to combine a few questions here, Chaviv, given the amount of questions. So both Charles Feynman and Theodore Shapiro are asking about the court cases and the corruption charges against Netanyahu and how that fits into the whole dynamic of the chaos you're describing. Theodore is going a little bit deeper and asking, really, is given the fact that it's more about personalities rather than political factions, and Netanyahu's longevity in politics, how do you distinguish between policy and platforms versus power? Maybe you want to talk a little bit about term limits or lack thereof in the land of the Hebrews, and given the fact that when Netanyahu was out of government, he was one of the largest advocates for term limits, but of course never came to fruition, and how that plays into all of this at large. So why don't we start with those, and then we'll go on to the next.
I just jotted it down. The court case, just very simply. It's been about 5 years now that this court, from the opening of investigations or when it became public, and there's been an indictment already for a year and a half or 2 years. The trial is already underway for many months, which is to say, when you look at a poll right now or anytime the last year, the court case is already very, 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 very deeply baked into those numbers. In other words, that everyone already knows, everyone has already seen, tremendous leaks both from the police investigation and from the defense and from everywhere. We know what Arnon Milchin's view is, and we know what Netanyahu's view is, and we know what Netanyahu's cousin's view is. And so it's all baked into the system. And just as a simple political point, if you're voting for him, you think it's less significant, either because you agree with him that it's a political, hatchet job slash conspiracy to bring him down, or because you just think he is not accused of mass murder. He is not accused in these indictments of these are fairly petty corruption accusations. I want to caveat that with case 4000, where there's potentially significant policy shift allegedly because of personal benefits to him allegedly. So in case 4000, that might not hold, but it's reasonable for a voter to say, look, I think Netanyahu is rescuing this country from Iran. I think Netanyahu is a good steward of the economy, all told. I think Netanyahu is a serious leader and a thoughtful leader and an erudite man. This is no Donald Trump in terms of the personality. I do actually want him to be prime minister. Even if he did these things, the country shouldn't pay by having someone much less, you know, fit for the job like Yair Lapid. I'm not representing my views. I'm representing an imaginary Likud voter. Even if he did this, it's not significant. So that's those kinds of views. He didn't do it. It shouldn't be illegal. Even if he did it, he's too important a leader to lose on something that insignificant. Those views are already baked in. So that's a simple political point. I think that beyond that, there is a culture war happening that's also very important to understand. And it touches on the second thing that you raised, which is policy versus personality. Israeli politics are not about policy. They never have been. The Oslo process, where the left adopted Oslo almost as a civic religion, and the right adopted opposition to Oslo as this just wild and passionate, again, civic religion, was a very strange moment in Israeli political life. We have Netanyahu tried to argue that the Israeli left is socialist and that there are a bunch of corrupt, about 3 weeks ago in a campaign video, that the Israeli left is socialist and a bunch of, and he has been a good steward of the Israeli economy, and a bunch of corrupt labor unions are going to take over the country if he loses the election. It was a little talking point he raised. And then the National Labor Union, the Histadrut, put out a statement that said, how dare you? Now, the person who put out the statement was a member of the largest faction in Israel's you know, labor union federation umbrella, which is Likud. Likud is a very significant part of the labor union movement in Israel. There are socialists and one of the most capitalist people who have ever been in an Israeli government and cabinet, one of the most free market, passionate, you know, economically liberal people is a man named Yossi Beilin, who was very significant in labor and the head of Meretz, or a party that was essentially Meretz in a kind of strange configuration. There are capitalists and socialists on left and right. There are, you know, questions of economic policy. We don't have a debate in Israel about healthcare. We don't believe that healthcare is a debate for the public. The public has no idea how to run a healthcare system. Why would you ask it? We don't have a debate on abortion. We don't have a lot of those social issues that divide left and right in Israel. Israeli politics are central, and the reason we have a national party list system, the reason the entire country is a single constituency on election day, and the divides of Israeli society are just essentially copy-pasted onto the parliament at election day. And that's the only electoral institution we have, right? Because we don't really have elections for other systems and other institutions that can veto each other. We might have the simplest electoral system on earth. And the reason we have it, or at least the reason we've kept it, when we've reformed just about everything else we've inherited, we kept the religious system, unfortunately, and we kept this incredibly simple electoral system, is that it allows the real profound social reality of Israeli society to express itself at the coalition negotiating table, and that is the tribes. The Haredim, the Mizrahim, the Ashkenazim, the secular, the traditional, the national religious, the ultra-Orthodox, the Arabs, the four different kinds of Arab societies that are radically different. I am much closer personally to, I'm an Odeh's culture and cultural universe than I'm an Odeh is to Mansour Abbas from Ra'am. I'm an Odeh is the head of the Hadash party. The two Arab parties are farther apart on every question you can imagine, from gay rights to just how he spends his day and whether his kids have cell phones, than I am to Ayman Odeh. So just this enormous divide, these cultural divides, those are what Israeli politics is about and what you see reflected. Shas gets elected to the Knesset and begins to negotiate a government with Likud. That negotiation is about Shas's constituents, who are a separate cultural reality that you can go and find and live separately and think and have a separate education system, by the way. Shas literally has its own education system. Its kids grow up in its education system, not in the education system my kids are growing up in. So welcome to Israeli society. We're a lot more Middle Eastern and Arab then maybe the West understands we really are half Arab. I mean, really, I mean, that's not only where half of Israeli Jews come from, it's in a profound way a lot of how Israeli society is structured. We look a lot more like Lebanon than we do France. I say that to say that the divide on the court case follows those lines as well, those cultural lines. And the divide that we see in Parliament that has created this deadlock follows those cultural lines. So the deadlock is deeper than the question of who here is a free market person and what do you think about abortions. It is kind of fundamental to who you are, where you live, how you were born, where you were born in Israel. As for term limits, everyone loves term limits until they're in power. I think that Netanyahu's overstayed his welcome for so much of the right, never mind the left. I say that just because that's what the right tells us, that we might see term limits once he's gone. It's awfully hard to do it to someone just elected because democracy, et cetera. But I think as soon as he's gone, there's going to be those term limits are going to come out of Likud, if nowhere else. Likud also notices that you can't advance under Netanyahu.
Good, thank you. Thank you for that. And so, again, as a segue to that, I mean, obviously, you know, the anthropological understanding of, you know, of the tribal politics of Israel, you know, so, you know, our friend and colleague Haley Faust is asking, you know, really, so if all, obviously everything you're describing is correct, then how accurate really are polls and outcomes in elections? You know, in the U.S., obviously they're off. So, I mean, you know, if really Israel, you know, as we know, is a, you know, is this kind of Lebanon tribal mentality, it's really about the tribal loyalties than they are about accurate polling. You started to touch on that regarding Arab polling, and of course, you know, Palestinian polling or a whole other ballgame of issues in general. So really, you know, are they, you know, what's the point, you know, as far as, you know, trying to gauge, you know, the Israeli public given the tribal loyalties versus actual, you know, polling data?
Polling in Israel is fairly good. There have been moments of real, you know, catastrophic error. Mina Tzemach is one of the most important pollsters in Israel. In April 2019, I think she was off by something like 10 seats, 10% of voters, which is inexcusable. It means that your model is bad. It means that you're not, there's something you didn't understand about the fundamentals of how the society behaves. Political polls are never clean. It's never just about asking people what they think and telling you how many said what. Political polls always have to take that data and normalize it for what the sample was, how big that sample is in the broader society. Sometimes they bring in other questions like, who tends to vote more often? Well, if they tend to vote 4% more than the other group tends to vote, I'm also gonna count them 4% more. You know, then you know, all these kinds of questions, then you begin to build these very complex mathematical models. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. I have to say that, you know, they talked a lot about how terrible polling was in 2016 in the United States. Polling was not terrible in 2016 in the United States. It fairly accurately predicted the popular vote across states. What it didn't predict is the very tiny margins of victory in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which is very hard to predict because polling has to work with the larger the numbers, the easier to get it right. So I think Israeli political polling is good. I can tell you that the political parties respond to the polling as if it's very good. We've seen polls leading up to election day bear out on election day, but Israelis also vote very tactically. When I say they're tribal, I don't mean that my tribe of right-wing Likudnik must vote Likud. What I mean is that they try and figure out what their kind of Israeli, religious Zionist, secular, Tel Aviv, periphery, Arab, this kind of Arab, that kind of Arab, this kind of Haredi, that kind of Haredi, what's in our best interest? So you see sometimes, for example, an exchange of several Knesset seats worth of votes between Shas and Likud. Those are Mizrahim who believe in this kind of traditionalist view of Mizrahim, of Mizrahim Judaism, which is something essentially invented by Ovadia Yosef, but we're not going to get into that. But they feel connected to that. They feel loyal to that. Sometimes Likud represents it better for them in their view. Sometimes they're afraid that the secular Ashkenazim are going to take over, and so they vote Likud to make sure that doesn't happen. And when they feel Netanyahu is safe, they turn around and vote Shas because that's the government they want Netanyahu to be leading, a government with a strong Shas. But they want Netanyahu to be leading. There's that kind of tactical voting, and it usually comes into play in the last few days. So there's a race on now between Naftali Bennett, Gideon Saar, and Yair Lapid for the left-wing vote, or the center-left vote, what used to be the Labour Party vote. It's a race between a religious right, a secular right, and a man who characterizes himself for many years now as a centrist for voters who used to be left. And it's a race for being the largest party in polls on the week of the election. In other words, you know, roughly March 19. Because if you're the largest center-left, if you're the largest, put it this way, anti-Netanyahu party in the polls on March 19, the voters who don't want Netanyahu will rally to you on March 23rd on election day. And that could be worth 10 seats. So polls up to March 19 will predict Yair Lapid at 16. But if Bennett and Saar each have 14, Yair Lapid might jump up to 22 very easily, and the polls are right. But you have to interpret them through an understanding of how the Israeli voter thinks of their own role in the election. That's just, I'm sorry, that might have been too long and complicated, but...
No, it's all good.
It's hard to read polls, in other words.
Yeah.
Polls aren't the problem. Okay. Learning to read polls is itself important. It's an important part of understanding what's happening.
Sure. Thank you. Let's try to get in a one or two more before our time ends. Let me try to unmute our friend, Robbie Friedman. Robbie, can you hear us? Robbie?
Robert Friedman?
Yes, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, hi. First of all, thanks. It was a really good presentation. My question is the anger at the Haredim growing enough that Moore's people might now vote for Yesh Atid?
Thank you.
Yes. First of all, emphatically, yes. Not only that, I think it's a threat to Netanyahu, and Netanyahu himself is aware of it and has tried to act on it. In other words, we watched Yair Lapid was second or third place to Saul / Bennett over the last month. Over the last really week, Yair Lapid has taken front and center and become the major non-Netanyahu candidate. And I think that's a response to anger at the Haredim. The discourse has become much more tense for valid reasons. The failure in the Haredi community and Haredi leadership has been really very significant. But also the anger at Haredim, we started to actually poll it on the right, which is fascinating. On the left, there was a wonderful poll, I think, for the Israel Democracy Institute about a week ago. It's not wonderful. It actually describes a terrible situation of tremendous social tensions. But the poll was very deep and insightful in that it asked the left, you know, do you want the next government to have the ultra-Orthodox parties in the government? And it was something like 80 no, 10% yes. And then it asked the right, do you want the ultra-Orthodox parties in the next government? And you can't have an Netanyahu government without the ultra-Orthodox parties, unless it's some kind of a, you know, centrist unity government like what we just had, which nobody really wants repeated. And you found more than 40% of the right no longer wants, and that's new. I don't exactly have the numbers in front of me. I think that's a jump of about 20 points. Mainstreaming the idea that the Haredi parties are actually hurting the country. And that's direct function of the pandemic and of the Haredi response to the pandemic, the failures of Haredi leadership.
Great, thank you. Alex, let me give you the last question, you know, with the time that we have to bring us home.
Okay, sure. I think this has been a very important presentation for us, for our listeners, because even, and I think maybe I said this before, that even those of us who are in observers and involved with Israeli affairs, Israeli politics, don't have a great grasp of the granular nature of the goings on. And so I guess my final question would be, what is your perception about the understanding of Israeli society, including elections, or exemplified by elections on the part of A, American journalists, B, American policymakers, and see above all American Jews. On one foot, if you please.
On one foot and politely. I I am in the frustrated camp. We are exotic. We are very strange. And the discourse about us doesn't acknowledge it, not among American policymakers who just don't understand why we can't just pull out of the West Bank already. That's a little bit cartoonish, but unfortunately not cartoonish enough. There isn't a good sense of the shattering of Israeli politics in the Second Intifada, which in the 30 years of elections before the Second Intifada, across the Yom Kippur War, across the 85 fiscal crisis where we lost the shekel and had 1,000% inflation, across the assassination of Rabin, the resignation of Golda, across all these tremendous political crises and collapses and disruptions. I think there were 6 wars, at least 2 in Lebanon in those 30 years between the election of 1969, right after we controlled the West Bank, and the election of 1999 before the Second Intifada. Israeli voter turnout never dropped below 77% or 78%, extremely, extremely high turnout. Literally 1,000% inflation, the loss of the shekel, the just assassinated prime minister, just all the traumas and all the wars, the Lebanon War, the Litani operation, the attrition war, the Yom Kippur War, every kind of crisis you can imagine, voter turnout never dropped. And voter turnout is a very, very significant indicator of trust and faith in politics to represent you and also to solve your problems. And then after the Second Intifada, the 2001 election, voter turnout dropped 16 points to 62% and has yet to recover to the minimum, to the low. It has yet to come within, I think, 8 points of the lowest it ever was before that. Israeli voters started voting in wild, crazy ways. You had a Kadima party that went into, I think, the 2013 election with 28 seats and came out of it with 2 seats. You started having these wild oscillations in Israeli politics. There's a shattering there. And when you come to Israelis and say, go talk to the Palestinians, everything is in the shadow of that shattering. And if you don't grasp that, you don't have to agree with it. You don't have to like it. You could tell Israelis, hey, you can't control another people, even if you feel bad about the traumas of your past. You can judge it morally however you want, but you have to understand that as policy, it is the world in which an Israeli politician operates. And you can't just come to them and say, don't operate in that world, operate in my world of the liberal Democrat, of the American Jew. I think one of the problems Obama had in this region with his foreign policy, which generally I thought was not a disastrous failure worldwide, and generally I also thought on his domestic policy, I can't imagine what a political party is doing not instituting universal health care accessible to all through the government. I'm an Israeli. There is no right-wing or left-wing Israeli who can imagine a world in which you don't have universal health care. In other words, I'm primed to be a very happy Democrat. But when he came to this region, I think one of Obama's failures was that he knew everything he knew about Israel, he had learned from American Jews. And American Jews didn't go through the Second Intifada in the way Israelis did. And their politics weren't shattered by it in the way they were shattered by Israelis in measurable ways. I use that as one big example, but just one example of many, many, many ways in which the American Jewish story, and which deeply informs the rest of the American story and American policymaking also on Israel, just doesn't fit the Israeli reality. I'll say one more sentence, and then I don't know if my time's up, but just one more sentence. I'm going to, again, be mean to Obama, but not because I think Republicans haven't had their share of, massive policy disasters that I don't understand, but simply because it's an easy thing to reach for. President Obama once said, I think after he had left office, the Israelis have to return to the liberalism of their past, to the liberalism of Golda Meir, to that period, to those ideals, and not get swept into this right wing, right? And to an Israeli ear, that's a fascinating thing for an American president to say, because it's hard to think of a measure by which Israel is less liberal today than it was then, by every measure I can imagine, whether it's Palestinians, Arab integration, equality, laws guaranteeing rights, whether it's, which didn't exist, the basic law of human dignity and liberty was passed in 1992. The question of Palestinian rights and statehood and the existence of Palestinians as an identity, the politics have radically shifted to the liberal. Gay rights, gay pride parades, just you will struggle to find a measure by which Israel is not more liberal today than it was, and still trending liberalward, despite the politics tilting right, but it's tilting right in certain issues, while gay rights has become normative even on the right. So in other words, it's moving in these complex ways. And I think what Obama really was expressing was the American Jewish feeling that he hears from his surroundings, that the Israel of Golda was an Israel I was proud of, and the Israel today is an Israel I'm troubled by. But that's about American Jewish knowledge. That's not about Israel. And really, one final sentence. I apologize for holding anyone over time. It's an important one. We are a democracy. We're a very weird democracy. We're a democracy without a Bill of Rights. We're a democracy without a constitution. We're a democracy without any kind of moment in which you can point to in which we decided to be a democracy. We're a democracy without Democrats, not uppercase, lowercase. We don't have a society that came here, immigrated here, from a democracy. We're not American Jews. We're the Jews who didn't get to America, and by the time we were looking for a place to go to, didn't have America as an option. We are Jews of Iraq and Yemen and Egypt and Tsarist Russia. We're Jews who the first time they had ever voted, something like 95% of Israelis, the first time they'd ever experienced any kind of democracy was when they voted as Israelis. And we have no rights. We don't have in law religious freedom. There's no law giving it to us. There's no freedom of the press in Israel in law. There's no freedom of expression in law, in an explicit law. We have all these things. We have them massively. The rabbinate exists on paper. It doesn't exist in my life, not in any real sense. There's a few questions of agunot, but they made the mistake of ever going to the rabbinate. If you don't go to the rabbinate doesn't exist for you. We have this enormously free, liberal society in the grassroots, in the real lived reality, but we don't have a law guaranteeing equality, but you can sue and win if you're discriminated against. But we don't have a law guaranteeing equality. Now, the Iranian and North Korean constitutions all guarantee equality. They don't deliver, but they guarantee it. We're a very strange animal. We are a democracy that you can't explain by any of the things they teach high schoolers in America that are the foundations of democracy. Where does our democracy come from? It struggles, it's got problems, but why is it even there? So there isn't enough of a sense, not in the policymaking world, not in academia, I believe. And I say that without knowing enough to say it seriously, but I will say it because I have a chance to. And certainly not in the media and not in the American Jewish public discourse, that Israel really is very different from American Jews. That even though we use words like Jew and rabbi and community and history, we mean different things when we use the word. And so that question that you asked is, I think, the fundamental question of the current age of the Jewish people. And the gap in understanding, and the gap is so great between American Jews and Israeli Jews, who together are something like 85-90% of all Jews, the gap in understanding is so great that I think it's responsible for a lot of the policy problems between America and Israel. And it's so great that we can't even see it. That's how big it is. We can't even see the extent to which we don't really understand each other, and that there are these vast questions we're not even asking because we don't understand.
Great. Well, that's a lot, but thank you for that. That was great. And thank you, Alex, for the question, and thank you everybody for joining us. I mean, this is a fascinating and a very valuable talk, echoing Alex's comment before, that I think is valuable to explain the growing divide between diaspora and Israel, and trying to understand in general, even not even between the Jews and American Jews in Israel, but also the larger divide between the Atlantic, to try to understand Middle East politics at large. There's a lot to talk about more that we didn't get to, and we apologize to anybody we didn't get to today. And please email us at bdsmonitor@sbmedia.org. Haviv, above all, I really want to thank you for taking the time to join us this afternoon. I want to thank everybody in the audience for coming and joining us, as always. And we hope to continue the conversation. And we hope you can maybe come back after the election and explain the results of what happened after the 23rd. And maybe we'll know more there or be more knowledgeable then again. But thank you again for everything.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having
thank
me.
You. Thank you, Alex, as always, and thank everybody. And I wish everybody a good afternoon or a good evening to you, Haviv, and a good morning to our listeners on the West Coast. So hope to continue the conversation and have a good day.